The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
Hopefully what it does is it really frees up lawyers to spend a lot more time on higher value work that doesn't get as much time today, and maybe to lower the cost of providing legal services so that more legal work can be done at a more reasonable cost, right? I think there's a lot of latent demand out there in the market, whether it comes from existing clients who just say, I'm going to do this in-house because it's too expensive to send it to my outside lawyers, but they'd love to. They would like to if the price was right.
Welcome everyone to The Hearing. I'm Janelle Wrigley. I'm a new regular host of the podcast, so you'll be hearing me from time to time in the rotation going forward. If you're an avid listener of the podcast, you might remember that I hosted a special series last summer called The Twill Takeover that was focused on issues of women's leadership in the legal industry. And as a regular host, I'll certainly continue to explore those themes, but lots of other topics and interesting guests as well. My guest today is Joe Green. He's the Chief Innovation Officer of Gunderson Dettmer. He's an expert in legal tech, legal innovation, and also a former transactional lawyer. If you're curious about, you know, what the skills you might need for the future, with all the legal innovation happening right now, or if you're curious about maybe pursuing a career in tech and pivoting from legal practice, Joe had a lot of great advice and insights about both of those things. So I hope you enjoy our conversation.
The Hearing.
Joe, thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast. I'm really looking forward to talking to you about really your area of expertise, legal tech and innovation with everything that's going on in the legal industry right now. But I wanted to start actually by talking to you a little bit about your career, because it's so funny. Over the years, I've had people reach out to me and kind of ask about, you know, lawyers asking about pivoting their career into more tech work. And I always think of you and I think, gosh, this person really should talk to Joe Green. So now instead of sending all those people to you, we're going to record a podcast and I can just send them the recording of this episode. I think you're just a great example of somebody who's really, you've had an amazing legal career. You've always just taken the reins, I feel like, and kind of directing your career in the direction that you wanted it to go. That's a little bit different from kind of the traditional path. So I just think it's a great example for people who are interested in doing things like that. I'll let you say hi though and introduce yourself and maybe just tell us a little bit about kind of where your legal career started.
Sure. Well, it's great to be with you here, Janelle. Great to see you as always. And I appreciate the efficiency play here for my time to get all of this advice out in one shot. Although I'm always happy to have these conversations with people. I think maybe it'll be helpful for me to demystify a little bit. You know, I think oftentimes when someone has a job that seems really cool and, everybody's like, wow, I want to figure out how to do that, they think, you know, by talking to me that they can figure that out for themselves. And, you know, I think that the reality of it is that there were lots of different junctions and decision points along the way and a whole lot of trying things that didn't really work out to kind of get here. Something that I remember very early on, maybe it was in high school or something like that, you know, reading biographies or news articles about people who seem like they had really cool jobs. The single unifying thread through all of those is that none of those people knew that those jobs existed when they were going through school and were kind of making their kind of early career decisions. And that was the case for me too. Didn't really know that this was a thing. When I was going through the early part of my career.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to tell the story and, you know, maybe that'll kind of help shed some light for people that, it's okay to flounder a little bit and, take some non-traditional, leaps of faith, along the way.
Definitely. Let's start at the beginning. So you started as kind of a traditional lawyer and then you pivoted at a certain point. So maybe walk us through kind of those early days.
Well, I met you at the very beginning of my legal career when I was a summer associate at Simpson Thacher in New York.
That's right.
coming from the University of Virginia Law School, that was not a strange or unusual or non-traditional path. It was tried and true. So joined Simpson out of law school, wanted to be a corporate lawyer, you know, kind of knew that from pretty early on. I was attracted to corporate law, transactional law. I was a business major in undergrad and just kind of gravitated towards that. Like many corporate lawyers, I thought that law was an interesting way to get into business potentially someday or leave open the avenue to being a business person someday. When I was at Simpson, I realized, especially in the years that I was there, right following the Great Recession, that making that transition is actually a lot harder than than it sounds when you're, you know, kind of thinking about it as a law student. But I went through all of the kind of core corporate practices at Simpson: banking, credit, M&A, capital markets, and I really was not looking to go to another law firm. You know, I was reasonably happy at Simpson. It's a great firm, great people. But I also knew that it wasn't, you know, kind of the lifestyle and what I wanted to kind of spend my life doing. But I wasn't sure what was. I thought I wanted to get closer to businesses, which for me made me think going in-house was, you know, kind of the next move. But I was relatively junior. You know, I was at Simpson for about 3 years. So kind of a rising fourth year when I left. And at that point in time, in-house jobs were scarce, unless you had 10 plus years of experience, just given the economic environment. And so a very crafty recruiter reached out to me and said, you know, I know you're not interested in law firms, so let's just chat. And I said, okay, I'll chat. And of course, they had a law firm that they wanted to send me to. It was Gunderson Dettmer, which I didn't know had a New York office at the time. This was, you know, 2011. And the New York startup scene was really just revving up, you know, kind of coming out of the dot-com era of Silicon Alley. And I went and met the Gunderson New York folks, really clicked with them. Many of them were, you know, people who had lateraled from firms like Simpson. Some of them actually came from Simpson. And I really liked the idea of tech. I was always kind of, you know, generally interested in tech and gadgets and things of that nature, and thought that, you know, if I was going to kind of have an industry expertise, that was something that was not going to go out of style in my career.
That was a great call on your part.
That was the bet that I made. So I went to Gunderson, really enjoyed kind of throwing myself into the startup world, learning about how startups work. And, you know, I was just very hungry and tried to soak it all up like a sponge.
For our listeners, we have quite a few listeners in the UK. Maybe just tell them a little. I mean, Gunderson is a firm that's kind of born in the Silicon Valley, I think. Maybe tell us a little bit about their, you know, what that firm is all about.
Yeah, absolutely. So Gunderson was founded in 1995 by a group of lawyers who left Brobeck. So founded in the heart of Silicon Valley in 1995 and, you know, kind of pretty quickly became a powerhouse in the tech world. The firm had and continues to have to this day a different strategy than all of the firms that you would generally kind of, you know, say in the same breath, you know, other kind of Silicon Valley tech focused firms. We don't have any litigators. We focus exclusively on transactional work for the venture-backed startup ecosystem and working with VCs and growth equity investors. So very targeted. We're not a full-service firm. We don't want to be a full-service firm. And I liked that focus. It still allowed you to be a generalist in terms of working with companies across the life cycle, across a bunch of different kind of aspects of technology or, you know, things that venture-backed companies do, but still really had, you know, a focus. And it's, you know, the firm that's done more venture financings than any firm in the world since PitchBook has been keeping records. In fact, we just had our 10th year in a row of leading the PitchBook league tables yesterday.
Congrats.
Thanks.
And then at a certain point, you pivoted away from practicing. So maybe tell us a little bit about what went into that.
Yeah, so that was the journey. You know, leaving Simpson was a decision point for sure, but it was going to another law firm, a well-respected law firm, who was a leader in its area. But I was practicing for quite a while. I practiced for over 7 years and was getting to the point of, am I going to be a partner here? Or am I going to, you know, if I stayed, I was going to be a partner. And, you know, I still felt that I wanted my career to go in a different direction. I was interested in other things. And so I tried a lot of different things. I had a stealth legal tech startup that never made it out of stealth. So never really got off the ground.
Probably a good experience, though.
It was very useful experience. In fact, I had a whole new level of empathy for founders who were going through kind of the trials and tribulations of that very early stage period. I also thought about being an academic and teaching in law schools. I wrote a law review article while I was practicing as an associate, and was applying to PhD programs in neuroscience, none of which wanted me because I was an English major and a business major and had no business apparently getting a PhD in neuroscience. So I tried a lot of different things and really kind of expanded my horizons to the possibilities of what, you know, what I might do. And that actually is, had I not done all of those things, I don't know if I would have taken the leap to join you at Practical Law. My next move was moving to Thomson Reuters, where I spent 4.5 years as a senior editor of Practical Law, writing startup law content.
Yeah, we were colleagues again.
Colleagues again. That's right. We keep bumping into each other. And that really, the idea for me in thinking about Practical Law was, you know, here's a way for me to write about things that I really feel like I know. You know, I had a lot of experience practicing, and they were looking for someone who could explain how to do startup law. And that was appealing to me. It was using the knowledge that I had gained over many years of, you know, challenging years of practicing, you know, in big law firms. But more than that, it also had kind of an academic and writing component to it. It had a lot more free time to focus on writing academic resource, you know, academic scholarship, if that was still something that I was, you know, kind of interested in pursuing. And I did. I wrote another four law review articles and a book chapter in the years that I was at Practical Law. But more than that, it really allowed me to kind of scratch that legal tech itch. I had these, some of these ideas that, you know, technology could, you know, really be used in practice to make people's lives meaningfully better and just remove a lot of the scut work and things that I hated about practicing. And Thomson Reuters obviously was, you know, at the forefront of that space, and gave me a real bird's eye view of the industry and all the different players in the industry and, you know, kind of product categories and, you know, difference between big law and small law and mid law and, you know, just all kinds of things that it would have been very hard to glean from the outside. So that was a really, ended up being a really fantastic move and a bit of a rebranding for me in a big way that led me to my next adventure.
Is that when you started to kind of meet people in the legal tech community in New York? I remember at the time you were often, you know, you were going to conferences, you were doing a lot of thought leadership in the space. You're not surprisingly, you were a superstar here at Practical Law. Did that kind of allow you also to sort of get into the network of people involved in that space?
Definitely. You know, I had an interest in it. My first legal week in New York City, the big legal tech conference, was actually when I was still at Gunderson, when I was working on, you know, thinking about that stealth startup. You know, I went during lunch and went to check out the exhibit hall. But when I got to TR and really, you know, kind of fell in with the crowd, particularly in New York, there was a very thriving legal tech scene in New York. Lots of companies, there was a very popular meetup that Christian Lang created that I started attending. And, you know, that was beneficial to me in my work at TR because it helped me meet a bunch of people across Thomson Reuters. I think my startup background, you know, working in startup law and understanding how, you know, the venture ecosystem works was kind of helpful in that regard. But really, I was interested in it and I wanted to spend as much time as I could, you know, kind of learning about it and seeing how the business of, you know, the different products that TR was working on, you know, kind of fit into the bigger picture.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then we couldn't contain you here at Practical Law. You moved on. But you didn't start, you're now the chief innovation officer, of course, at Gunderson, but you didn't start at that title. So maybe walk us through a little bit kind of how you went back to your firm and your path there.
So actually my academic work in some way led me back here. I decided to write a book chapter as part of an academic book that was called Legal Tech and the Future of Startup Lawyering. And it was kind of this thesis that I had been building in my mind about that, you know, startup focused law firms, you know, are likely to be at the vanguard of adoption of innovative technologies because of the nature of their clientele, as opposed to having big banks and insurance companies who kind of tell their law firms, you can't use anything that, you know, that I don't give you permission for. You know, the clientele in the tech world is obviously quite the opposite. There's cost pressure. The nature of the work, many of the deals, tend to be driven by, kind of relatively standardized forms. There were just a whole bunch of different factors that I saw that I thought were really driving the industry towards an inflection point where it was going to have to really change its service delivery model. And so I wrote about that. And then I started talking to all of my friends in Gunderson's New York office who at that point had become partners. We sort of got to a place where I was talking about it so much and telling them, hey, these are the things that I think you guys should be thinking about and doing, that they said, hey, we're actually looking for someone to come back and do those kinds of things here. What do you think? And so I basically got to, more or less write my own job description or I wrote a job description. They wrote a job description. They were pretty aligned, worked out well. So the first role that I came back, really largely the same job, it was a different title, director of client experience. So I worked very closely with a colleague of mine who's still my partner in crime, who's now our chief knowledge officer. And he had moved into his role after practicing at Gunderson for 8 years and then was the first kind of lawyer who moved into a knowledge management role at the firm. He was ostensibly more focused on internal kind of process improvement, and with the client experience, my mandate was to focus on kind of the external pieces of what we were doing. But in reality, we ended up just kind of working hand in glove, like two startup founders of our internal skunk works, and that's more or less how we still work today. So the project's kind of always been the same, and then after a few years, they elevated both of us to the C-suite.
Great. And what does your day to day look like? What does a chief innovation officer do?
Oh, so many things. we've grown our team quite significantly. So we have, a variety of different people that are part of our kind of broader group. Some of them formally sit within IT and they're, product specialists in many of the Thomson Reuters products like Contract Express, HiQ. They really understand how to get every last drop of juice out of those products. We have a whole team now of practice innovation attorneys who do knowledge management and innovation work. So some more focused on technology and kind of process improvement, others more on kind of content and precedent management and data tracking. So we have that kind of part of the group. And then we also have some full stack developers, data engineers, data operations folks on the team as well. So I spend most of my time kind of, mapping out what is the long-term plan on all of the very, very many irons that we have in the fire at one time. And then kind of bouncing around those different groups, just to make sure that everybody's kind of coordinated, has what they need, knows what kind of priority, what to prioritize. It's effectively a product management job is sort of the way that I think of it. Like our product is delivering legal services and this is the group that's trying to figure out how do we systematize that as much as possible. Scale it, have quality control, and think about new ways of delivering those services.
Yeah. I want to talk about some of the irons that you have in the fire in a second. But before we move on to that, just to kind of wrap up the career piece, if it's possible to kind of distill, any advice you might have for a lawyer who's thinking about, wanting to transition into legal tech or into the innovation space. Is there anything you would say in particular to them?
Yeah, I have these conversations with a lot of folks who are interested in this kind of work, and it's heartening to see how many people are now interested in this. I think one of the things that I see, and this is true of kind of many career paths. Like when I was a junior lawyer thinking about going in-house, if I wanted to go in-house, I was most likely going to have a selection of jobs that were very different than if I stayed to be an eighth or ninth year associate and then went in-house, or a partner who then became, chief legal officer of a big company, right? So the more experience you get in a particular area, the more expertise that you build, the better the opportunities potentially are. And so there's a balancing act. If you go to law school and you're interested in legal tech, I do tend to think that there is a lot of benefit to spending some time in the trenches doing the work, and really understanding not only a bit about the actual work itself, but the business as well. And you don't really get that until you've spent, kind of a decent amount of time practicing. It's not for everybody. And it's not to say that there aren't other paths. But I do think that, one of the one of the things that I feel I really bring to the table is that, you know, I really understand the work that we do for clients, what matters, what doesn't matter. And that just makes it much easier for me to think about how to re-envision it. You know, it's like breaking grammatical rules as a writer. You know, it's fine for Shakespeare to do it, right? You know, I mean, you kind of have to get to a certain level of proficiency before, you know, you can, I think, really effectively bring about change in these types of organizations, and also have the credibility to be taken seriously by the people whose behavior you're trying to change.
Absolutely, which makes it a challenge too, because once you have 7-8 years of experience under your belt, I think people find it can be hard to leave that path. There's a lot of pressure to stay on that path and either make partner or even, you know, there's all kinds of reasons why people want the stability of kind of staying where they are. So
absolutely.
That makes a lot of sense.
The Hearing.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
So turning to some of the things that you're working on at Gunderson, a big one that I've read about is ChatGD. So I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about what that is.
Sure. So this was not something that I was on my master plan roadmap when I came back to the firm of things that we would build. This was a bit of a curveball.
This seems to be happening everywhere. I don't know.
For sure. So I had. I had already with our team gotten some experience of working with large language models before ChatGPT became publicly released. We were using it for data extraction use cases, not generative use cases. So we were writing natural language queries and then basically, you know, using those to structure data points from documents that we wanted to capture. And so we had some experience basically doing what they call prompt engineering now, before that was a well-known term. So we understood the power of the technology, but we also understood the limitations and the challenges of working with the technology and its kind of state at that point. This was pre-GPT-4. And then I would say, you know, when ChatGPT came out, there were a bunch of people on my team who were kind of trying it out and playing with it and thought it was, you know, pretty interesting. When GPT-4 came out and you saw kind of the step change in capabilities of what GPT-4 was capable of doing, that was around the time that everyone in the legal industry really started paying attention, because that's also when Casetext and Harvey kind of came out with their big product announcements. They had access to GPT-4 long before it was released and had products basically ready to go out of the gate. So there was a lot of buzz in the legal industry about generative AI at that point. And we found ourselves in a position where, like many of our, you know, fellow firms, that our malpractice insurance provider was writing blog posts saying you should not, you know, lawyers should not be using ChatGPT. It's not ready for prime time. Don't touch it.
Oh, interesting.
And it ended up taking a kind of a sit down at our annual partner meeting with, you know, partners and executives on the technology side, on the risk side, our managing partner, our general counsel, all sitting down together and kind of figuring out for Gunderson, for a firm that, you know, works with the most cutting edge startups incorporating AI into their products and is advising them about the legal issues, that understands the technology, you know, what's the right approach for us? And we ended up coming down on the side of allowing folks, you know, not banning ChatGPT, but reminding people of, you know, the guardrails that they need to have in place to use it responsibly. We also started looking at the third party tools that were available, because, you know, we could tell pretty quickly that this was going to be a pretty transformative technology and didn't want to just, you know, kind of sit on our hands, especially with the position that we took on ChatGPT. But when we were looking at those tools, it was kind of at the peak of hype, at least, you know, at peak of hype and where there were very few options on the market. So the companies that had options, you know, had an offering in the space were very busy working with a handful of firms. They knew what they had. They were extracting very large amounts of money for the, you know, kind of those early adopters. And, you know, we kind of took a look at it. And frankly, for us, the amounts that they were trying to charge for a new product category that was untested, we didn't know whether people were going to use it, find it valuable, you know, we didn't think it was responsible to just kind of plow forward and you know, kind of pay that amount of money. And around the same time, we got access to the OpenAI models through Azure that were enterprise grade. So we were comfortable with the terms that they weren't going to be using the data to train the models. So we weren't worried about that kind of data leakage that you had with ChatGPT, the public version. And around the same time, there were also a number of open source projects that were coming together, things like Llama Index and LangChain, that really facilitated, you know, standing up an application that could do generative AI, at least, you know, kind of the basics of it, relatively quickly and easily for a skilled developer. And so, you know, given the internal resources that we had, we thought, why not give it a try? Let's see what we can do. Let's, you know, at a minimum, we'll learn about it and we'll see what it's capable of today and be able to play with it. Who knows whether we'll actually build something that other people in the firm will use. But the end result was something that we thought would be really quite useful to people and be an improvement over our attorneys using the public ChatGPT, which is what we were permitting them to do. So, you know, that was kind of the calculus was, you know, if we can provide something cost effectively that, you know, allows them to really get some experience with it, because that was the main thing. You know, the main thing we wanted was for people to just start jumping up the learning curve of what these tools are capable of, how to interact with them, how to get better results from them. And so we built this application that we called ChatGD. It basically had two features. One was enterprise grade ChatGPT. Just chatting directly with a large language model, in our case, GPT 3.5 Turbo, and getting back whatever results you get back, hallucinations and all, whatever it spits back at you, that's what you get. We didn't do anything to it other than make it so that it was going through an enterprise grade connection that, you know, the data wasn't going to be used to train the underlying model, with Microsoft's assurances. I think the more interesting piece of it, was something that was not available just kind of generally. This was what Case Text and Harvey were doing, which was retrieval augmented generation, or RAG. And what that effectively does is allowed our end users to upload a suite of documents, a certain number of documents. There was no actual upward limit, but we encourage people to keep it relatively small so that they could go and manually verify the information. And then that allowed them to basically use that suite of documents as the context for their chats. So basically to be able to pull information from those documents from a trusted source, from something that wasn't, you know, something that the model was just going to make up. So it, you know, dramatically cut down on hallucinations, made the outputs more reliable and usable. And so those are the two features that we launched, ChatGD. We launched it back in August. We were the first firm, I think, in the world to launch something that had both of those capabilities at that time. You know, a lot of good learning has gone on since then.
Yeah, what's been the feedback and what have been kind of the use cases that lawyers have been excited about?
So a big part of the rollout of the tool was about training. One of the things we learned during our beta period was that there were a lot of folks who are generally sophisticated about technology and work in the tech space who were asking a language model to do things that it's just not built to do at all and being confused as to why the outputs were not what they expected. So we spent a good amount of time trying to explain to people in a you know, not super technical way what this technology is, what large language models are doing under the hood, and what retrieval augmented generation is, and also how our application was built, so that they wouldn't have these kind of inflated expectations. And we gave them some examples of, you know, good use cases, things that it's built for, and use cases that it's not built for. It's not a Google replacement. It's not a search. It's not a search engine. It's not a replacement for Westlaw.
Thanks.
A little plug there. We, you know, kind of focused on that in the first case, and we steered people towards the use cases that we thought would be really valuable and the things that we found it valuable for, which were largely language manipulation tasks. So giving it some language and then asking it to do something with it, change it in some way. That could be adding additional language to it, modifying language. We had, you know, some board resolutions that were all gendered, you know, male gendered, that we said make this gender neutral. A lot easier than doing that with a control F. But then also for email communications, you know, draft this, make it, and you could iterate on it, right? Make it friendlier, make it a little more formal. Now change this part of it, right? So we were trying to help people come up with ways that they could interact with it, particularly in relatively low stakes ways or very easily verifiable ways, because our cardinal rule was, if you can't personally verify the accuracy and completeness of the output, you should not be using it for this, because it's a very bold and convincing liar. It doesn't mean to, it just doesn't know. It's a pleasing machine. It just wants to, give you whatever it sounds like you want. And sometimes that means that's going to make things up. That was part of the education, but we have seen people really gravitate towards those kinds of use cases and come up with some really interesting things. That we had one associate who reached out to us very excited. This is the kind of feedback you love to get when you're doing this kind of job. He said, "You guys probably already know this, but I discovered that if I tell the model to ask me any clarifying questions it has before it gives me a response, then I get like, you know, it goes from being like a bad junior associate to like an all-star junior associate." And you looked at the questions that he was getting, and it was like, yeah, these are the kinds of questions that a bright, thoughtful young person without a ton of experience in an area would ask. But really what he had figured out how to do is to hack the model to force him to give it more context, because the more context you give it, the better the responses are going to be. And it's a drag to have to think of all that stuff on your own and type it all out. So making it more conversational feels more natural. It's more human. That was a really cool insight.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And it strikes me just the same way when you're first managing a junior associate and you have to learn how the best way to work with them, to work together as you move up in seniority. It's the same kind of thing. You have to learn how to work with this function and how to kind of get it, unlock its potential, I guess.
Absolutely. Actually, hopefully our former managing partner won't be mad at me for sharing this, but when we were doing our beta period, he played with it a little bit and he told me, "I gotta be honest, Joe, I'm not that impressed with the results. You know, I asked it this question and this is the answer, and I don't think it's very good." And I said, I hear you, but that's actually not a very good question. So much of this is learning how to ask it questions to get what's the right input to get the output that you're looking for. And that is a learned thing. It's not that natural, at least at this stage of the technology. And I said, that's the point, and it's the same thing I used to say to myself so often when I was a mid-level associate, managing, junior associates for the first time. I'd give them something to do, I'd get something back, and I'd immediately see how terrible my instructions were. And I knew that was my fault. That was my bad. They had no context. And I learned early on that when you're working with people who are smart and eager and motivated, the more context you give them, the more they can use their brain and the better the results that you get. And it takes time up front, but you get better work on the back end. It's the same. It's the same as working with an assistant, working with anyone. But these models have their own kind of idiosyncrasies in terms of the way that they like to, that they need you to communicate with them. And that's a kind of a newish thing to learn.
And do you find, I mean, your lawyers are probably particularly open to, technology, given the kind of profile of Gunderson, but do you find that they've been willing to kind of set aside the time to do that? I think it's always difficult with busy lawyers to probably convince them to spend a little time with something that's a little unfamiliar.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a mixed bag. And we rolled it out not just to attorneys, but to the entire firm. And I'd say we've had about half of the firm has at least gone in there and tried it. We definitely have some power users and the usage has been steadily increasing. It's growing and people are going back to it and giving it a second try, but we also haven't been like really pushing it. Because again, it's not at this stage of its evolution, we're not telling anyone, hey, this is how you practice now. This is which when you're doing X, you go and use the large language model or you use ChatGPT. We're not telling people that. It's still meant to be a learning and experimentation tool. And people are going to come to that in their own time, in their own way, and kind of when they have the bandwidth, mental bandwidth and time to do that. But we have tried to stress for them that this is going to be table stakes for knowledge workers. And the technology is going to get better. This is the worst it'll ever be. But it is also something that just as there are people who are better at finding things on Google and there are people that are better at finding things on Westlaw, it's a skill. And the sooner, especially for people who are going to be practicing for a while, the sooner that you start building those muscles, the better you'll be. And you'll have a kind of marginal advantage over anybody else who's doing that kind of work.
Yeah. Do you foresee a day, maybe not that far off, when it becomes part of kind of law school research curriculum? I mean, it's so funny to me to think back when I was in law school. It was a while ago, but not that long ago. They were still teaching us how to do legal research using hardback books, like just in case, you know, it was there. And, you know, they also obviously we were using online research platforms. So it's funny to think about how it takes a while to displace the old ways of doing things.
I remember going down to the Simpson Thatcher Library and looking at some books at yes. one point. Yeah, no, absolutely.
And we still worked with plenty of lawyers back then that was how they had practiced as juniors. All the juniors would be down in the library all day long. So that legacy kind of, there's a long shadow to whatever technology, you know, people have started their careers with. But I would imagine that law schools are going to have to start, you know, incorporating this into their curriculums.
I was having a conversation with a law school professor the other day, and he was saying that most of the conversation when this first came out, instead of being focused on how are we going to teach people about this, was focused on, well, now I can't give take-home exams anymore. And that was what hours of faculty meetings were spent discussing instead of what this means for like what they need to educate people about. So I think they will come to it. I think they will come to it a little bit late. I think it is another example. I think where practice is going to lead the way and do a lot of the training. But, you know, I think, you know, in the same way that Westlaw, you know, and Lexis have provided law students with accounts for years and they kind of, you know, learn to some degree in law school, I think, you know, for things like case techs, co-counsel, like I'm sure that will be the case as well. I was at Harvard Law School earlier this year to do a session about AI and ethics. So kind of the story that I just told, like the ethical considerations and the decision making. And I'm going to go back and do a bake off for another class of different AI tools. So there's definitely interest, but it's just also kind of new and evolving.
And so with Gen AI generally, you know, we're at this moment of time, you described some of the use cases that you're seeing within Gunderson. Looking ahead, where do you see it? And, you know, where do you see it going in terms of how lawyers might eventually be able to, you know, make the most use of large language models and Gen AI?
So my hope, and from what I've seen so far, you know, I think this is the direction that it's trending, is that, you know, the way that our lawyers have been using the tool that we have is to take a whole bunch of tasks that are frankly mundane kind of scut work and make it easier and faster. And so, you know, I think that that's going to continue, and I think it will move up the value chain to higher value tasks. But my hope is that what that really allows is for practicing law to seem a lot more like what I thought it was when I was in law school, or hoped that it was going to be, and a lot less like what the reality is. Because the reality of what very high-priced lawyers spend a lot of their days doing is necessary work, but not work anybody gets out of bed in the morning happy to do. It's not fun. Nobody says, oh, I went to 3 years of school to make signature page packets or, you know, make this timeline or, you know, whatever. And so, you know, I think that hopefully what it does is it really frees up lawyers to spend a lot more time on higher value work that doesn't get as much time today, and maybe to lower the cost of providing legal services so that more legal work can be done at a more reasonable cost, right? I think there's a lot of latent demand out there in the market, whether it comes from existing clients who just say, I'm going to do this in-house because it's too expensive to send it to my outside lawyers, but they'd love to. They would like to if the price was right. To the whole, you know, swath of unmet legal needs, you know, and with access to justice. So I'm bullish on it overall. And I think that, again, you know, people leveraging these tools, they're tools at the end of the day. You know, as long as people are involved in commerce, it's going to be gray and messy and machines aren't going to fully understand it. And there's going to be work for humans to do. And so I think, you know, people with these machines are going to be able to just do a lot more and do it, you know, focus more on the high value things where humans really have the magic.
Everyone loves to talk about Gen AI these days, but I imagine there's probably other things you're working on and excited about at Gunderson. So what else do you have in the fire?
Yeah, in some ways, Gen AI has seemed like a distraction from my day job, even though I've spent a lot of time on it. You know, it's very exciting, but in terms of the immediate impact that it's having, it's nothing compared to the other things that we're working on, which, you know, are around using technology and better process that can leverage the technology to do, you know, things that you don't need generative AI for. Generative AI is not very good at just drafting a contract from scratch. And guess what? No lawyer wants to read that contract. They want to start with a contract that they already know that's been vetted and used in the past, right? So document automation technology, transaction management software, all of that kind of stuff, that's still where we're spending a lot of our time. And frankly, data is the place that I am, the thing that I'm most excited about and the place that I spend most of my time is working on our data operations, and how we can better leverage the data that we have access to, but also the relationships and the network that we have as a law firm. That's so much of what our value proposition is to our clients. We don't really charge them for it, but that is, you know, a big part of why you go to the firms that you choose to use. And, you know, firms historically have just not been very good at being data driven in any kind of sophisticated way. It usually just involves whatever's in people's heads, being the kind of primary source of what's market, what you see, you know, what's typical, which is so much of, you know, what people want from their lawyers.
Yeah. And so for data for a law firm, is that the precedents? Is that analytics or all of the above?
Yeah. So there's a business angle to it. There's kind of business intelligence and kind of understanding the business better, understanding the work that we're doing and how that impacts the price and the time that it takes to you know, complete the work, and what the factors driving up cost are. It's the actual work that we're doing for the clients and what we see across the broad swath of our clients, which again is why people come to us, because we have a, you know, so much market share that we have a better understanding of the market than firms that don't do as much of this kind of work. And, you know, beyond just, you know, kind of basic analytics, it's, you know, kind of more advanced things like machine learning and, you know, being able to be more predictive, finding signals in, things that you might not otherwise think are a driver of certain, you know, certain outcomes. You know, litigation, I think has gotten a bit ahead of it. It's, you know, kind of this money ball mentality. So, you know, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, I think is really exciting and, you know, that I think is a large part of law firms' value proposition in the future.
Yeah. I mean, Gunderson is obviously very well positioned. I mean, you wrote a whole book about this, sort of being on the leading edge of adopting technology, pursuing innovation because of your client base. And you have, it sounds like quite a large team there working on these things. Do you see other firms, moving in the same direction as Gunderson? Do you think they will have the same ability to kind of push into innovation and technology the way that you have? Is it required to succeed in the future? You know,
maybe I'm biased, but yeah, I think if firms that are not focusing on this and invest and making investments now, I think are going to be caught quite flat-footed as the industry changes, and I think significant changes are coming to the industry. That said, I think a lot of firms are taking this seriously, and a lot of firms, I mean, you know, chief innovation officer is not a, you know, kind of wackadoo title anymore of like, what does that mean? Or, you know, never heard of that before. You know, there are a lot of firms that have someone in my kind of role. Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be increasingly important to focus on building systems and productizing a lot of the work that we do, paired with the bespoke, you know, kind of customized personal advice. You know, I don't think it's going to be one or the other. It's going to be both of those things together. You know, trying to build the kind of scalable systems, you know, it's a full-time job. It's not something that I think, you know, busy practicing lawyers can do as a side hustle.
So, you know, I hear fairly often, actually, lawyers, you know, people talk about lawyers as being, you know, resistant to new technologies or sort of slow to adopt maybe new ways of doing things. And there can be all kinds of reasons for that if it's true. So I wanted to just ask you, how do you respond to that point of view?
It's a common refrain, no question, certainly in the circles that I run in. And, you know, often it has kind of a, you know, an age valence to it, that it's a generational thing, right? In my experience, that's not really the case, that it's an older generation of lawyers has no interest in this, and a younger generation of lawyers are all about technology and are digital natives. I've actually found that, you know, within each of those kind of cohorts, it's still a spectrum. And, you know, there are first year lawyers who don't seem to be very interested in using technology tools or find it daunting. You know, enterprise software is not like using apps on your phone or, you know, whatever, whatever the kids are doing these days. and then some senior lawyers, are, you know, kind of still open and interested. You know, for them, obviously the value proposition of learning a new way of doing things, when they've been doing things a certain way for a long time and have a limited amount of time left in practice is, you know, sometimes not the highest. And it's rational for them to say, you know what, I'm fine with the way I know how to do things. But I think that that whole, outlook is a little bit true for everyone. You know, when you're brand new and you're learning how to do something for the first time, that's the time where there is no change management problem. And so often I think, you know, if I want to change behavior, I need to start from the very beginning and say, hey, this is how we close a deal here. This is how we draft documents here. There is no Word document. You do it through software. And then there's no resistance. There's no problem because they didn't know how to do it before. There's no switching cost. For people that have a way of doing something already and they've learned it and it works for them, then there's a change that's necessary. And even if something is better, one, they have to be convinced of that. And two, if there's a learning curve to it or a switching cost associated with it, if the thing that you're working on is something that's high risk, high pressure, then it's very understandable why people say, I'm overworked. I don't have any time. You know, I barely see my family, much less, you know, want to spend some of that spare time learning to do a new thing. And then when it comes to the doing the work that's really high pressure and time sensitive, that's not the time for me to start learning how to do something if I know how to do it the way I know how to do it. So it's very understandable, actually. And I think that's, again, where my background having practiced and knowing I probably wouldn't do it or I'd be resistant to doing that. What I've found is that particularly asking people for, you know, kind of very specific, what's seemingly kind of small and trivial changes, but that are still kind of a pain is very hard. But if you can convince people that like what you're working toward, if you can sell them a vision of what their future could be if they buy into it and tell them, hey, there's a bunch of different pieces of this that we have to put in place. And none of them individually are going to seem to you like, well, who cares if I do this? Is that big a deal? But like, we can't get to the place that's going to be a much better place for you. You know, a place where your practice will be fundamentally different and we can take away a lot of the pressure and the scut work and, you know, the things that are quite challenging. That is what I've found to be most effective, but it's always a slog. It's never 100%. You know, and it requires a whole bunch of different approaches. Top down, I mean, getting a partner to tell associates or paralegals to do something is always more effective than having me do it. But then bottom up as well, right? Like, that's not necessarily sufficient. Lots of people, their partner tells them to do something, they sort of do it their own way anyway and hope nobody notices. So convincing them of the usefulness and how it fits into the bigger picture, again, giving them context, you know, I think is really, really important. But it's also a lot of work. It's hard to build these things and then spend the time to kind of nurture them and roll them out and implement them. And that's why it takes more than, again, somebody doing it as a side hustle or, you know, just a couple of people to do it at a complex organization.
It sounds like two completely different jobs, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what, you know, we have listeners really all over the world who are lawyers or legal professionals. What do you think they should be doing? You've touched on, I think if you're, people are listening closely, they'll have picked up on some pointers already. But what do you think they should be doing to kind of prepare for the new innovations that are coming and, you know, to kind of build skills for the future?
Yeah, I think that if you're someone who has any meaningful time left in your career, in your practicing attorney, there are really two things. You know, one of them is to lean into some of these technologies and at least trying to understand them. A lot of the technology that's rolled out today is not geared towards senior practitioners. It's geared towards more junior folks because that's where a lot of the more commoditized, repeatable, routine work is done. And that's where the kind of lowest hanging fruit is. But there are a whole bunch of things that can make even experienced practitioners much better at their jobs. It's a competitive market out there. So I think, you know, at least spending some time, you know, as you can to try to be familiar with what's available and, you know, new ways of doing things is helpful. And for young career lawyers, you know, I think, you know, early career lawyers, It's an imperative to try to be as good using the tools of the trade, the new tools of the trade, as possible. But that's not likely enough. There may be, you know, a cohort of lawyers out there who just become really skilled at kind of working the machines and working the tools and you know, kind of pumping out the more routine work. But, you know, I think the most attractive jobs are going to be the ones that, you know, in the kind of associate to partner pipeline, the things that are gray, complex, require a lot of human judgments and interpersonal skills. So I think honing those soft skills and the things that are, you know, kind of truly human and irreplaceable, you know, that's the right bet to make. If you want to have longevity, in a changing industry.
I love that. Lean in on being human in the new era. That's great.
Always good advice.
Yeah. Joe, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time. It's been really interesting to hear about everything that you're working on and appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing. Or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.